Today is February the 17th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is also available on prn.fm on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Maryland becomes the first state in the country to place a tax on big tech's digital advertising revenue. Maryland decided to take a chunk of big tech's advertising dollars on last week, successfully passing legislation that would place a maximum tax of 10% on revenue from digital ads. Analysts estimate that the tax will generate about $250 million in its first year, money that Maryland says will go to schools. State lawmakers overrode Republican Governor Larry Hogan's veto of the tax bill, making Maryland the first state in the country to tax digital advertising sold by companies like Facebook, Google, and Amazon. Hogan vetoed the bill in May of last year, arguing that it would raise taxes and fees on people in the state who were out of work and struggling financially. As explained by the New York Times, the amount of tax paid would depend on a company's global revenue. Companies that make at least $100 million, but no more than $1 billion, will have to pay a 2.5% tax on their digital ads. Meanwhile, companies that make more than $15 billion in global, that's global, worldwide revenue per year, will pay a 10% tax. Bill Ferguson, the Democratic president of the Maryland State Senate and one of the main proponents of the tax, said in a Facebook post that the tax law will make big tech pay its fair share of taxes in the state, just like small businesses. Companies like Amazon, Facebook, and Google will have seen their profits drastically decrease during the COVID-19 pandemic, while our Main Street businesses are struggling to keep up. Ferguson said, at a time when Maryland's budget is being impacted in unforeseen and astronomical ways due to COVID-19, Maryland families and businesses can foot the bill, or big tech can start paying their fair share. The law faced opposition from the Silicon Valley lobbying groups, state Republicans, telecom companies, and local media outlets, per the Times. Opponents argue the tax would not be paid by big tech, but rather by small businesses that buy the ads and their customers. Marylanders for Tax Fairness, a group that represent businesses against the law, railed against Ferguson in a statement accusing him of raising taxes on Maryland residents during the pandemic. This tax increase was historically short-sighted, foolish, and harmful to countless small businesses and employees, and Maryland will remember it that way, said Doug Mayer, the group's spokesman. Nonetheless, the fight over the digital ad tax isn't over yet. Mayer said his group would continue to oppose the tax wherever possible, including in a court of law. The Office of Maryland's Attorney General, Brian Frosch, has stated that while there is some risk that courts could find some provisions of the law unconstitutional, it should survive a court challenge. Maryland's tax could propel other states to move forward with similar efforts. Connecticut and Indiana have also introduced bills aimed to take a slice of big tech's digital ad revenue. Well, if my math is correct, for any one of the big tech companies with ad revenue of $15 billion or more, 10% of the global ad revenue would be taken out by Maryland. If 9 other states did the same thing, then all of the ad revenue is taxed, and then there's no income to pay for any expenses. In Aesop's tale of killing the goose laying the golden eggs, the tale has given rise to the idiom, killing the goose that lays the golden egg, which refers to the short-sighted destruction of a valuable resource, or to an unprofitable action motivated by greed. With Maryland's taxation and Connecticut, Indiana soon following suit, something does not compute. That's almost like taxing an imaginary number. So, what's the latest programming language? I think you're going to be in for a surprise. It may be the oldest piece of software still in widespread use. It was 34 years ago, just 3 years after Apple introduced its very first Mac, that Microsoft released the first version of its familiar Excel spreadsheet app, and initially a rough copy of Dan Bricklin's VisiCalc. Fast forward to the future, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella was calling Excel's Microsoft most important consumer product, pointing out that it has over 750 million users. Excel has been upgraded with a major new feature. Microsoft researchers believe they are now finally transforming Excel into a full-fledged programming language, thanks to the introduction of a new feature called Lambda. With Lambda, Excel has become Turing complete. You can now, in principle, write any computation in the Excel formula language. Being Turing complete is the litmus test for a full-fledged programming language. Microsoft researchers are enthusiastically envisioning skilled Excel users creating functions that appear seamlessly part of Excel to their colleagues. Excel users do much of their work using formulas, where the input into a cell starts with an equal sign, followed by some kind of calculation. Microsoft's formula are the world's most widely used programming language, yet it had always been limited to a predefined universe of options. To wrote their own custom functions, users had to use Microsoft's other macro basic programming language, Visual Basic for applications, JavaScript, and Microsoft JavaScript Super TypeScript. Excel formulas are written by an order of magnitude more users than all the C, C++, C#, Java, and Python programmers in the world combined. By now, all those users can write actual programs without leaving the world of Excel formula. More specifically, formulas written in Excel can now be wrapped inside the named Lambda function, and it can then be called from anywhere else in the spreadsheet. And yes, it supports recursive programming, so you can even call your name function from within your name function. The names are supplied in the name manager choice tucked away in Excel's formulas toolbar, and users can enter a comment when creating their function. Excel promises more array manipulation functions are coming in the future. Microsoft's research even promises the company is working on efficient implementation of array processing combinations such as map and reduce to be used on the output of name functions. For Simon Peyton Jones, this represents the fulfillment of a long-standing dream. Back in 2004, he said, "I learned that Excel is like a supertanker. It has very high value, it has a very large mass, and it's operated by a surprisingly small and heavily overworked crew, so it's not easy to change course." But 10 years later, he discovered that one of the mid-level programming managers had since been promoted to be the great boss of Excel. Suddenly, we began to get senior executive-level buy-in. Even more important, the engineering support to make it happen. Microsoft research calls this new Lambda feature a qualitative shift, not just an incremental change. Name Lambda functions offer programmers a high-quality language-like attribute of composability and reuse, respecting one of the long-standing principles of good coding, namely not repeating work. A name function can even become part of another name function elsewhere in the spreadsheet. But that's just the beginning of what could be even more elaborate constructions, where several different functions, each defined in different cells, are collectively used to define a larger function. Last year, Sarkar co-authored a paper imagining a new Excel concept called gridlets, in which a selection of cells could be copied and pasted, allowing the reuse of a group of formulas, ultimately offering a kind of object-oriented counterpart to sheet-defined functions. Excel as a programming language. Right now, it's only available to members of the Office Insiders program beta channel. Although even with that program, eager users complained that they weren't rolling it out fast enough. Within the first few weeks of Lambda being released, There were videos with hundreds and thousands of views on YouTube. So if you want to know more about it, it's on YouTube. The post on Microsoft's Excel blog ends by promising name Lambda functions are just the beginning, and they added with a comment to join us for the journey. Robocalls and scam calls persist during the pandemic, so Americans have stopped answering the phone. Is it safe to answer the phone? The short answer is no. It's probably a robocall spammer. Sometimes they claim Social Security Administration or the Internal Revenue Service is on the line. They aren't. Neither service will ever threaten you or demand immediate payment on the phone. Or they call saying your car's warranty is expiring and that your credit card interest rate could be lowered. 3 out of 4 Americans said they were targeted by phone scammers over the last year. The bombardment of robocalls, many of which come from scammers seeking to bilk you out of money, has led many to simply not answer the phone when the caller is unknown. And for good reason. On the average, those who fall for scam calls lose $182, with some losing more than $500. According to the survey of more than 2,000 consumers and 300 business professionals conducted in the last week of last year, the robocall and scam call deluge has led many to just avoid answering their phone. About 94% of those surveyed said they let unidentified incoming calls go unanswered. That comes at a time during the coronavirus pandemic when consumer and businesses' use of phone calls nearly tripled, increasing 184%. Businesses are using their voice call more than ever to reach customers, and the public are picking up the phone to connect with friends, family, and colleagues. At the same time, this crucial communication tool is being hijacked by hackers and scammers, exploiting our need to feel connected and informed. The robocall bonanza shows no sign of slowing. More than 4 billion robocalls targeted phones across the United States in January of this year, which is a 3.7% increase over the month of December. During January, robocalls averaged 129.5 million calls daily, or about 1,500 calls each second. Robocalls did decline slightly in 2020 as the COVID-19 pandemic resulted in the closing of some call centers. The estimated 45.9 billion robocalls to consumers last year, however, was 50% more than 2017. But the robocall volumes appear to be resuming their slow journey back toward their pre-pandemic levels. During the coronavirus pandemic, new types of phone scams have arisen, including those promising tests and cures and expedited stimulus payments and texts about COVID-19 support and pandemic tracing. But many of the traditional scams remain tops and have more targets since many Americans are at home and using their smartphones as their main communications device for work and personal calls. The reality of it is that the fraudsters are always changing tactics. They are always trying to figure out how to pounce on whatever is the latest trend, and is obviously right now there's fraud happening around vaccinations. There's this cat and mouse game that's always happening. The amount of consumers not answering unidentified calls, 94%, is significantly higher than last year, than a year ago, 72%. It may seem counterintuitive, but that increased rate of unanswered calls can only lead to more calls being initiated. Businesses have expensive call centers too, and when calls aren't answered, whether that's customer service or sales, and if people end up not answering those calls, what do you think they do? They call more. So legitimate businesses, not just fraudsters, are actually calling more because people are answering less. Public health can be impacted too, as COVID-19 vaccine scams have more than doubled since September. Scammers can take advantage of interest in getting vaccinated, and confusion about the vaccination process is alluring a lot of victims. But that doesn't take into account the lost time that scam victims spend extricating themselves from scams. Add that in, and the lost funds and productivity to scam calls likely suppressed $10 billion last year. regulators, wire providers, and security companies have focused on blocking robocalls. The Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission have fined phone companies allowing coronavirus-related robocall scams. The FTC has worked with the Justice Department to block illegal robocalls, and the FCC is requiring phone companies to adopt new caller ID features by June 30th of this year. Those actions would combat spoofing, where a false caller ID makes a call appear to be coming from a nearby location. You're buying a computer and you're confused. Should you get lots of cores in a CPU or just a faster CPU clock speed? And you ask questions like, how many cores do I need? Is it better to have more cores of a faster processing speed? Or is 12-core 3.5 gigahertz system worth it, or should I just get the 6-core? Back in the year 2000, with the release of the first Intel Pentium 4 chipsets, processor speeds topped out at 1.5 gigahertz, and you would have to wait until 2005 to see the first Intel dual-core processor hit the market. But what does this all mean? Clock speed? Multi-core? Hyper-threading? Dual processor systems? If computing is a car, then the CPU is the engine. The higher the clock speed, the faster the car. Or, in this case, the faster the system will go. Clock speed is measured in gigahertz. A higher number means a faster clock speed. To run your apps or your application, your CPU must continually complete calculations. If you have a higher clock speed, you can compute these calculations quicker, and applications will run faster and smoother as a result of this. Up until 2005, virtually all the processors on the market were single core. The fastest processor was always the best choice. Nowadays, processors have multiple cores, and systems can be built with multiple processors, each with multiple cores. Multiple core processors became popular as it became increasingly difficult to increase clock speed on single-core processors due to technological limitations. Rather than trying to engineer working for an extra 1 GHz in clock speed, manufacturers instead added more identical processing units to single processors. A core is a single processing unit. Multi-core processors have multiple processing units. So a single-core 3 GHz processor has two processing units, each with a clock speed of 3 GHz. A 6-core 3 GHz processor has 6 processing units, each with a clock speed of 3 GHz. The 6-core processor I've just described has a total clock speed of 18 GHz. That means your programs will run 6 times faster than with a single-core 3 GHz, right? Well, not exactly. Multi-threading and hyper-threading. Multi-cores and multi-processors may help your apps run faster. This is where multi-threading and hyper-threading comes in. Multi-threading is the ability of an application or operating system to utilize multiple cores for processing. When apps are written with multi-threading in mind, they can benefit from the cores available in modern CPUs and see huge performance increases over using a single-core processor. So what if your app doesn't support multi-threading? First off, this is a rarity. However, if your applications by some chance don't support multi-threading, you will still be better off with as many cores as possible. When your apps only support a single thread and you're using a multi-core system, they will get whole cores to themselves unless you are running more single-core apps than you have cores, rather than sharing cores as they would on a single-core system. So more cores is a good thing. Multi-threading support is even better. Well, what's hyper-threading? Hyper-threading is a proprietary Intel technology that allows a single core to split into virtual and logical core and share workload between the two. Hyper-threading is especially useful where apps are well-optimized for multi-threading. Well, what about high clock speed versus more cores? And that was the original question that I asked. The benefits of a higher clock speed and the performance boost more cores can offer. Do you go for a processor with a lower clock speed but more cores? or one with fewer cores but a higher clock speed. First off, if possible, you want to go for the one with the highest clock speed and the highest amount of cores due to budgets. However, this isn't always possible and is usually a trade-off between core and clock speed. So what are the pros of more cores and slower clock speed? Applications that support multi-threading will greatly benefit from having a higher number of cores at their disposal. Increasing the number of cores in your CPU is a cost-effective way of increasing performance. Multi-threading support for applications will continue to improve over time, and you will be able to run more apps at once without seeing performance drops. Great for running multiple virtual machines. Well, what's the downside? Lower single-thread performance than higher clock speed processors. Fewer cores, high clock speed. And the pros on that is that you have better single-threaded performance and lower cost option. And what are the downside of having a single-core system or fewer core system? Fewer cores to split between applications. Not as strong multi-threading performance. And the best thing to do in most cases is to look into the support your applications of choice provide for multi-threading. Following this, you can decide whether you'd be better off with, for example, a 3.46 GHz 6-core system or a 2.66 GHz 12-core system, assuming that cost is about equal. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Workday CEO and Work From Home.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. It's time for us to talk about how IT and the work environment and everything else is constantly changing. And yes, COVID has been responsible for a lot of us moving to this work from home environment, this entire situation, which has a lot of people very happy, a lot of people finding a lot more flexibility, a lot more ability to do the things that need to be done with family during a tough time. Now, Workday CEO Anil Bhusri, I'm not sure I said that right, Bhusri, so he said perhaps 5 days is too much family time. That's his exact quote, referring to, of course, working from home. Along in that conversation just a few weeks ago, he indicated that most of his staff are going to be back to the office as soon as he can make them. He did this on a public call, and apparently a few people poked at him and said, yeah, maybe backpedal a little bit. So he did say, eventually on that same call, that a few days at home might be okay, and he did acknowledge that there are mental health benefits and other benefits of working from home. Now, this is very interesting. Workday is a human capital management company, meaning they should be already good with their employees and have a good pulse on what their employees and what your coworkers and your employees and your managers really want. It doesn't seem like they have a good, solid understanding on that, especially since a recent survey by a company called Korn Ferry, where they asked 1,000 professionals what they most looked forward to about returning to the office. 20% of them said nothing. Nada, zilch, zip. I don't want to go back. There's nothing there for me. At the same time, half of them said that they were actually still concerned whenever this all rolls out with the COVID vaccines and so forth. As this progresses, they still say, well, we still have health concerns. We still have these different issues that we say, we're more comfortable at home. Now, all of this has really, really started to get us thinking. What are the things that really drive us back to the office? Only 30% of the respondents, the 30% of the 1,000 professionals, said that they think they are going to be going back to the office whenever it reopens. As a matter of fact, many companies these days are already planning on some serious downsizing, not of the people, but of the properties of all of these different office towers. That's why we have a mass exodus of various companies and people from inner city areas like downtown New York, downtown San Francisco, downtown Los Angeles, downtown Houston, down. You get the idea? All of these different office towers. People are saying, why am I going to go back? There are various things that really are resistant or build resistance. One of the things I am really, I'm looking at the idea of, I don't really care to commute anymore. Of course, recently I've had a very short commute. I haven't had a dramatic commute, but over the years I have had commutes which were an hour away each way. That's pretty rough. That's 2 hours a day that you're spending on the road. What are the various upsides to working from home? There's so many. So we do lose out. I will admit that there is some loss of some of the social interaction, seeing your coworkers and being able to stand in front of them and discuss things, having the coffee break together. I will tell you that everybody seems to have adapted where I work, and we do a lot of casual conversations on our various instant messaging, and we'll have phone calls with each other, and there's a lot of the same level of water cooler chat. You know the nice stuff. Hey, how you doing? I haven't talked with you in a while. How are you feeling? Everybody doing okay in your family? And I'm actually finding out more about some of my coworkers' families than I had learned before, just because we're starting to show concern for each other. We're starting to reach out and really touch base with a lot of these people that we've worked with for many years. No matter what happens with this back to the office or continuing to work from home situation, it's going to be complex. It's going to be quite a bit different than we've ever had before. I'm excited about this. I'm excited about the prospects of us being able to be a little bit more flexible. I've always enjoyed some of the promising items of desk hoteling, where you go in for a matter of 1 or 2 days into the office and you get assigned a desk and your phones, they go through to there, and all of your stuff, you hook up your computer. And at the end of the day, you just take your laptop with you and you leave. And then you can work from home, or you can work from the coffee shop, or you can work from wherever you want. And that's an exciting possibility to me. And I like that. And I hope that we continue with that, where we work where we're at. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Inquiring minds want to know, should you charge your smartphone overnight? For those with a smartphone, it's a ritual to charge the phone overnight. Some people say you should never fully charge a phone, while others say that modern batteries are designed to allow it. You want to keep your battery in top condition, meaning fully charged, but at the same time, a dead one renders your phone useless. Have you been doing things right or wrong when it comes to keeping the juice flowing to your phone? Your battery's performance will decline over time. What do the manufacturers say? Apple spells it out plainly, saying that when your iPhone or iPad remain at full charge for prolonged periods of time, battery health can be affected. Android phone manufacturers such as Samsung have similar advice. Do not leave your phone connected to the charger for long periods of time or overnight. Huawei say that keeping your battery level as close to the middle, that's between 30% to 70% charge, as possible can effectively prolong battery life. The official word is to keep your phone charged, but not fully charged. your battery will stop charging at full charge, but once it drops to 99%, it will need more energy to get back to 100. This is unnecessary and it eats away at your battery's lifespan. If you must go to 100%, unplug your phone from the charger as soon as you hit that maximum. This is obviously not possible if it happens while you're sleeping, which is why it's not a good idea to leave your phone charging overnight. Don't drain your battery completely. You may have heard that your battery works best when you consistently charge from 0 to 100%. So if you keep charging your phone from 25% on, your battery will only remember the last 75%. This may have been the case with old NiCad batteries, but smartphones are now equipped with lithium-ion batteries, eliminating the cycling memory. Some smart plugs and smart outlets automatically stop charging your phone when it reaches maximum capacity. Some apps do the same job, in addition to monitoring your battery usage. Be sure to charge the phone to 50% when leaving your phone stored for an extended period of time. Turn it on every few months and charge it back to halfway if needed. Your smartphone battery is sensitive when it comes to temperature, especially heat. Don't leave your phone lying out in the sun or under your pillow. This not only is bad for your battery health, but it's also dangerous. High heat can break down the battery's internal cells and cause a short circuit. This can make the battery itself heat up and melt, swell, or even explode. Modern phones have safety features to prevent these extreme occurrences, but your battery will still be damaged if it gets to that point. There are computer programming languages, and there are computer programming languages. There is no one best computer programming language. The best programming language does not exist. The computer press is forever promoting the latest programming language as if it was the soup du jour. I find that with every programming language, I am exposed to solving problems in new and interesting ways. No language is perfect. The problem with arguments about the best programming language is that any claim you could possibly make in favor of one language over another is fraught with exceptions. It is easy to find exceptions and counterpoints that poke holes in every argument. When programmers bring up language features in an argument, it's generally safer to stick to the argument that a language is better because it has more features or better features. As soon as you try to point to specific features, those features, well, evaporates in the argument. Is it better for a language to have garbage collection or direct control of memory? Is dynamic or static typing better? Should the language be primarily procedural, functional, or object-oriented? What about concurrency support, first-class functions, metaprogramming, generics, blocks, or closures? Every additional feature adds complexity to the language and cognitive load to the programmers that use it. I like the quote that more is not better or worse than less, just different. It's commonly taken for granted that high-level languages are better for programmer productivity, and we continue to pursue higher levels of abstraction. But sometimes programming in lower-level language can be more productive. Even seemingly safe arguments like no one still codes in assembly aren't always true. Assembly may seem like a dead language that's only useful as good learning experience, but there still are real-world cases where it is necessary. Each language is expressive and powerful in the domains that it's good for. The bottom line is that it depends on the context. Programmers can and will write bad code in any programming language. At the same time, great software that adds tremendous value can also be written in almost any programming language. The best programming language may not exist, but there are plenty of good ones out there for writing great software. COBOL is not a dead programming language. While there may not have been enough COBOL programmers to fix New Jersey's unemployment system, the language still runs in the world's economy. Last year in April, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy announced that the state desperately needed programmers with COBOL skills. The state's unemployment insurance system got overwhelmed by a surge of COVID-19-related unemployment claims, creating a backlog in processing cases. The system ran on 40-year-old COBOL applications and there weren't enough people familiar with what most assume was an antiquated programming language. The fact that the system was running apps written in COBOL made it to the news accounts. Many saw it as yet another sign of America's deteriorating infrastructure, and to most people unfamiliar with the ins and outs of mainframe computing, COBOL was something from the age of the dinosaurs. The Computer Press was reporting that not only was COBOL pretty much a dead programming language, but that COBOL programmers was a scarcity because there weren't many still alive who had experience with it. But COBOL is far from being dead, and not just because it runs some old state government system. If not today, chances are you've used a COBOL-powered system at least in the last few days. Even though IBM and the mainframe community pointed out that nearly every credit card purchase or ATM transaction depends on mainframe running applications written in COBOL, the perception was that any COBOL programs still in use are ancient legacy applications that need replacing yesterday. It is estimated that there's about 1 billion lines a year of new COBOL code being written. So while they are maintaining existing programs, there's still a lot of COBOL development underway. As for shortage of programmers that were part of the story, that's not exactly true either. Governor Murphy's problem wasn't a lack of people with COBOL skills, but a lack of COBOL programmers in New Jersey where they're needed. There's this myth of a shortage of COBOL programmers. There really isn't. There's a lot of people that know COBOL. It's just that there's a geographical issue. But COVID-19 has forced us to address that so people can now work remotely, and we will have a shortage of COBOL programmers within the next 10 to 15 years because nobody's teaching it. But right now, we've got plenty. It's just a question of the employers knowing where they are and allowing them to work remotely. While news accounts fed the perception that New Jersey's system fell down because it's antiquated, the main problem was that the system wasn't being properly maintained. These legacy programs are in constant need of updating and refreshing and enhancements. IBM comes out with a new mainframe every 2 years, and that new mainframe always had added functionality and added features. So the COBOL compiler had to be updated to take advantage of those innovations, and the existing code needs to be modified accordingly. Because of COBOL's famous fault tolerance, the software probably didn't show any sign of underlying issues until the onslaught of COVID-19-related claims led to rapid scaling. COBOL is so stable that it just runs in the background, and you don't know there's a problem. Other programming languages are problematic. You update the hardware when something breaks. You look at the code, and you got to replace it, renew it, rewrite it, or whatever. COBOL just runs. It just works with very little care and feeding. COBOL has a 60-year longevity history, and that 60 years is not like we did it 60 years ago and then left it alone. It's continually being reviewed, updated, and improved. So you have 60 years of refining both the hardware and the software pieces of these applications. They run pretty well now. They're pretty solid. COBOL is an acronym for Common Business-Oriented Language. It is primarily used in business, finance, and administrative systems for companies and governments. It was first released in 1959, and it's designed to be easy to read by a human, which makes the language easy for students to grasp. COBOL is not a very difficult language to learn. It's very linear. It's very self-describing. The verbosity that people criticize it for, I think, is one of its strengths, and it tells you what it does. Since the brouhaha in New Jersey last year, there have been a concerted effort to train more COBOL programmers. The Open Mainframe Project now offers a free online training course, in addition to having created the new COBOL working group, whose mission is to promote the language by changing its perception and making materials more accessible to help more developers and students learn it on their mainframe journey. Those wanting to learn COBOL can also take advantage of free courses at IBM, which has skin in the game as the sole remaining mainframe manufacturer. IBM even holds a free annual competition. COBOL is essential to the global economy. It belongs somewhere in the college curriculum ongoing, so that should be one of its goals. COBOL is hardly taught at all in the university computer science programs. The problem is not a lack of interest among students, it's a lack of knowledge of the platform. Younger people don't even know what the mainframe is or what it does. learning COBOL can give a career boost to budding programmers. Banks and other institutions that rely on the language will move employment applications to the top of the stack when COBOL skills are indicated. People need to understand that this stuff is still in use. COBOL is a very important language. It's not dead. It's not dying. It's going to be with us for a long while. It's a great way to start your career. You certainly need to learn Python and Java and other languages, but it gives you something that other folks don't have. Presenting Marty Winston with All Hands on Tech, Generator Power.
Have you ever seen a vehicle that runs on natural gas? It's true for many city buses in many places and some delivery vehicles. So obviously it's not impossible to convert something like a car engine or a truck engine to run on natural gas or on liquid propane gas. And that's exactly what runs whole house backup generators. Now think about it. What might you expect that engine's maintenance requirements to be? Come on, that's not a trick question. It's the usual engine maintenance stuff. Changing the oil and the oil filter, replacing the air filter, making sure the battery that spins the starter is okay, and the solenoid that connects the battery to the starter. Occasional spark plug changes, maybe an occasional tune-up or double-check the timing. But remember, if that engine is running a backup generator, you're not putting a lot of miles on it. It might run every so often as part of a self-diagnostic, a self-test mode. That doesn't take much. And of course, it can just keep running through outages, which aren't generally more than, hours to days long. For most houses, a smaller air-cooled engine can handle everything. For mansions or places with huge power consumption, you may want to bump it up to a water-cooled engine, which also means attention to the radiator and to antifreeze. But overall, you're not looking at huge maintenance needs or huge maintenance costs. Still, many people who buy backup generators from the most heavily advertised brands can end up paying far more for the cost of a maintenance program, far beyond recommended. It's required, mandated in the purchase contract. And that's not the only gravy they'll be forever hitting you up to deliver. Of course, they'll tell you convincing stories about why it's a better value for you when those are included, and maybe some horror stories about real or imaginary people who ran into terrible trouble by breaking the contract and never again paying for those things. Hey, Brooklyn, sell me a bridge. Speaking of selling, the colder or stormier or otherwise more disruptive the weather, the hotter the season for those generator sellers. Because when blackouts happen, as they so often do, they hit most people totally by surprise. Not many people plan for an outage, and zap, no power. You can guess what emotions surround that. Anger, fear, frustration. That leads to thinking, I'll never let that happen to me again. And that leads to a lot of soft targets for those slick generator brand commercial and ad campaigns. Which itself should raise a little yellow flag. If they're delivering a good value to their customers, how can they possibly afford that huge ad spend? The money has to come from somewhere, and spending it needs to be justified by some even larger amount as a return on the advertising investment. Can you feel their fingers reaching for your wallet? There you are, inconvenienced, vulnerable, looking for a way out of outages ever again bothering you. And there they are, talking about how they're somehow leaders in providing their answers. You'll only hear one brand name in this segment, and it's not the one that keeps demonstrating a need to feed the greed weed. We'll get there in a moment, but first, let's talk tech. How much power does your house need? Make that, how much power does your house need at any one time? Few homes, very few, use as much as 20 kVA. For simplicity's sake, and adjusting for a variable called power factor, that means 15 kilowatts of power, 20 kVA, 15 kilowatts. If you were to run absolutely everything electrical at the same time, you might push your usage past that. But it's not that hard to keep things sane. For example, if you have an all-electric HVAC system, an electric oven, an electric dryer, and an electrical outage going on, do you really need to dry clothes and bake a turkey at the same time? 20 kVA happens to be about the biggest load that a smaller air-cooled engine can run. Some of them do 20 kilowatts, which, as you know, is a little bigger because of power factor. A lot of them are 20 kVA. For the sake of simplicity, let's peg that 20 kVA as our desired capacity. What does it take to get a generator installed and running? That depends on the generator and the philosophy of the company selling and installing it. Here are some of the elements of an installation that get lost in the noise level when you start looking at generators. Outdoor concrete pads or other housing so the generator isn't just sitting on mud. A manual or automatic transfer switch so the generator automatically switches itself in and out of providing electricity as utility power disappears and reappears. A through-wall power connection. A connection to your load center, the breaker box, you know, that box with all the breakers in it. And they might try talking you into a load-shedding configuration that automatically disconnects selected power consumption items when the rest of the house starts drawing too much power. There might also be a charge for a special kit if you live anywhere where the temperature drops below 0 degrees Fahrenheit. Each thing on that list adds hundreds to thousands of dollars to your bottom line price tag. And that's before they layer on those mandated annual service and support fees, separate layers for some of them. So, with some sellers, it's less like buying a product and more like funding somebody's unfriendly divorce settlement. Or so we're told. Judy and I are coming on to 42 years of a first marriage for both. After years of looking into residential generator makers and talking to them and grilling their people at trade shows and a lot of other homework, there's one that may deserve your attention. Disclaimer time. That one, they are not providing any payments or products or anything else to anybody here. This is based on investigation. None of us has any of their products installed or running. No money and no product passed in either direction informing this recommendation. It's just earned. The company is Cummins, C-U-M-M-I-N-S, Cummins. It's their model RS20AC. Letter R is in Romeo, letter S is in Sugar. Number 2, number 0. Letter A is in Abel, letter C is in Charlie. RS20AC. It includes a 20 kilowatt generator and a 200 amp service entrance automatic transfer switch. The options you may want to consider include an outdoor mounting pad and an extreme cold weather kit. But do your own homework. Find dealers for any brand, every brand that interests you. Ask smart questions. If it's a 20 kilowatt residential backup power generator with an automatic transfer switch, an outdoor pad, and a cold weather kit, find out what the bottom line price is for each of those sellers to do the full installation. Remember, that could involve feeding a gas line through a basement wall. That bottom line should include all the parts and all the installation charges. And make very sure to ask about what ongoing commitments are riding along that will cost you more money every year just to keep it running. That's called TCO, short for Total Cost of Ownership. And total must mean total. Then make your best choice. Next time, there are still so many questions and there's still so much misunderstanding about UVC that it seemed appropriate to get back to basics and help make understanding hard ultraviolet a little easier. Join us for our UVC primer, because when you're not confused, you're much less likely to get bamboozled.
Thank you, Marty. Coming up March the 20th, the 45th Trenton Computer Festival. It is the original personal computer festival. The Trenton Computer Festival, TCF, was created back in 1976 as an annual educational event with speakers, forums, and user group meetings, an exhibit area, as well as an outdoor flea market. But with the pandemic, all that got changed. TCF 2021 will be held as a virtual event on Saturday, March the 20th, 2021. It will be a full day of learning and fun. TCF 21 is free via Zoom teleconferencing to all. Donations will be welcome and accepted to offset expenses. All you need is a personal computing device, like a personal computer, a tablet, and maybe perhaps a little difficulty, even a smartphone. The TCF keynote speaker will be Jerry Foster, and he will be talking about how I learned to stop worrying and love artificial intelligence. He is the CTO and co-founder of Plex Systems. This keynote provides an overview of artificial intelligence from its humble beginnings to disruptive force, with an eye towards the significant positive impact on our world. For the festival, there are planned 10 simultaneous tracks during the course of the day, covering over 50 talks and workshops, special exhibits and demonstrations. Here are some of the highlights of some of the talks. Do-it-yourself home automation, tips and tricks for Windows 10, quantum computing, WordPress Bootcamp, new Internet of Things using 5G, stock market trading using neural networks, hands-on Arduino workshop for beginners, get an amateur radio license in a day with ham, cram, and testing, and many others. There will also be meetup rooms to greet and meet friends from the past. The website for the festival is tcf-nj.org for more information. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on current trends in personal technology, Thursday, February the 25th. Meeting time, 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation, Focus on Digital Cameras, Thursday, March the 4th, 2021. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, their meeting is March the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, March the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, March the 12th, 2001, 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is LIMAC, LIMAC.org. Our website is PCRadioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.